I do appreciate you calling. It's the great Joe Perry from Aerosmith, and a big aloha and mahalo. That's what we'd say here if you were in person, Joe. Plus, I'd be giving you a big hug.
Well, it'd be great, and I'll tell you, we do love Hawaii. What island are you on?
We are in Honolulu, but we broadcast statewide, so it's nice for you because you get to talk to everyone, but I'm in Honolulu.
Great.
You have memories in the book. Of course, we're talking about Rocks, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith with Joe and on All Things Considered here. And one of the things about it is you do have a piece of history, a signature song, I would even say, that's attached to a sound check in Honolulu. I'll let you tell the story because it'd be much better hearing it from you.
Well, as songwriting goes, it's you never know when things are going to hit you. And as it turned out, we were doing a sound check at the HIC, and I was trying to just kind of fooling around, trying to get my sound. And I was thinking, you know, one of my favorite bands, The Meters, they're a band from New Orleans, kind of a real funk band, you know. And
love them, seen them many times.
Yeah, and I was thinking, we should have a song that kind of comes from that school. And I mean, there's always been that funk kind of R&B thing in our music anyway, so I thought, you know, let me see if I can come up with something. So I had Joey lay something down, like pretty generic, and these riffs started coming out. It worked, and they turned into Walk This Way. To make a long story short, I mean, it was really one of those moments. You know, sometimes you can pound away for hours trying to get something, and other times it just flows through, and that was one of those times. Basically, all the riffs in the music that I wrote happened at that sound check at the HIC. And, of course, then we went to the record plant in New York, and then Stephen had a go at lyrics and things, and we were kind of up against the wall. You know, he was having the trouble with coming up with something, and they went out to see Young Frankenstein, which was playing in one of the theaters around there. When they came back, they were all, you know, laughing and throwing lines back and forth from the movie. And somebody, I think Jack said, our producer said, you know, did his impression of Marty Feldman doing Walk This Way, and somebody said, wow, that would be a great title for a song, or that would be a great line for the song. And Stephen heard that, and they went, just give me a couple of minutes, and, you know, which turned into a couple of hours. But he came back and with the whole thing, and it finished it off, and then that was it, and the rest is music. But yeah, that was the original pieces of music came from that sound check in on Oahu.
Was that your first visit here to the islands?
It may have been the first or the second, I'm not sure. I can't remember. Probably the first, if I was to look at the timeline. But, you know, it was, I mean, we were so infatuated with Hawaii. You know, I have so many memories of being in different places. I could probably go back and look at when the song was put out, you know, and all that, and figure it out. But it was one of our first two times that we were in Hawaii, and I fell in love with it. So, in fact, that's where I ended up getting married, you know, at the I.O. Needle years later. So
it's a trip, man. Have you been out to Stevens Pad out in Maui?
No, not yet. I haven't had a chance. He's been saying, you know, I'll give you the keys. Come on out. And I've just been so busy. It's I can't wait to see it. You know, though I don't know. After he's, I haven't really heard from him since he read the book. So I really, really don't know if the offer still stands. So I don't know.
You said something about inspiration, Joe. I just want to tap it quick because that's one thing about the book that's fantastic. Rocks, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith. You and you have this, I guess, when your parents went to BU in Northeastern, you have this very scholarly background of reference when you remember yourself. So kudos to them for instilling that, because it helps when you're doing interviews. But you said something about the inspiration part, and sometimes it comes to you quick. Sometimes it's slow, and it was almost like we were getting into your head on the way some of these tunes have come. When you were thinking that, what are some of the tunes that the inspiration came, you know, really fast, or in other cases, it ended up being a really long labor, but when you look back at it, it's such a big part of your legacy now.
Some of the stuff that Steven and I wrote when we were first learning how to write together, he had been in other bands before. I think he had 3, 4, 5 bands. At least one of them had like a single deal, and they had put out a couple of pop songs that really didn't do much. But you know, up in New Hampshire, one of them was on the jukebox. So you know, it was kind of the closest thing to a local rock star at the time. But you know, it was really kind of big fish in a small pond kind of thing. But
small lake that would be
in our way. Yeah, but. So it was almost a pun, but so we were learning how to get the most out of each other. Mostly, he would play drums and I would play guitar, and we would just have a tape recorder going, and stuff would come out. Like songs like Same Old Song and Dance and things like that, they just came right out. And he had a packet of lyrics left over from his songwriting days with his other bands. And I know he dipped into that quite a bit on some of those original songs. But then we really started to, but you know, most of our stuff was that we played live was cover songs. And we just started adding the original stuff as we kept writing it. But then when we got in the studio for Toys in the Attic, that's when I started to realize that if you wait around for inspiration, you're going to be waiting for a long time. you know, chances are you're going to be finding an awful lot of excuses to go to the beach instead of sitting there, you know, with an empty pad of paper or an empty reel of tape. So it was really like learning how to do it. We needed a song, say, like literally like Toys in the Attic, Jackson. We need another up-tempo song, and he started tapping out like kind of the tempo he was thinking of on his thighs, and a riff just came out, you know, the riff to Toys, and that's kind of how it went. And then when then Steven was like singing along with it, and before we knew it, we had a song. It took about a half an hour to get the guts of it together. And then there's other times where we would just go down and we'd go just every day. Later on, we'd show up at 1 o'clock at a studio. Eventually, we just started doing it at my house because I had built a studio there. But wherever it was, we have to get into a routine. You get there, you get settled, you know, get the tape rolling, and then you just start jamming around. And then you start pulling stuff out that sounds like it could be useful. There's kind of a good window to that in that video, The Making of Pump. We had a guy like following us around with a videotape recorder. You know, this is back before everybody's cell phone was a camera and a tape recorder and a computer and all that stuff. But anyway, you can see how the process would go. We would sit there and Steven would, you know, go between playing drums on the piano because he could get the samples to sound like drums. And also he could play chords. And I would play guitar, and we'd get the drum machine going, or he would play the drums, and the songs would come out. That was probably when our partnership as songwriters worked the best. But as soon as started bringing in outside writers, it kind of upset the balance, so to speak, and very often things would... Well, anyway, it's in the book.
Yeah,
things got a little weird. You know what I mean? I think that when you have a songwriting team, no matter what goes on personally, you know, or whatever, you know, there's got to be a certain amount of trust, and apparently you missed that part. Anyway, there are some examples of that in the book, but hey, that's part of, you know, how he is. You know, that's his like I said in there, his moral compass was obviously set in a different set of parameters than mine. So, he seemed okay with the way we dealt with things, and I had to learn how to deal with that.
On the flip side of that, though, thinking about you and your personal life, were you smart enough during that era to just bank all that stuff when you were doing those crafted tunes and you were obviously, because I used to go and see, I'd hang out with like Mark Pereno, and I saw some of the record, you know, 8, 9, you know, whatever number of platinum discs on the wall, all these awards you were getting. So it makes me think the flip side of those Diane Warren or whoever it was who was writing those tunes, were you able to put that stuff away and feel good about what you have and what your kids have and security?
As far as what?
I mean, I guess I see, like, there's a sacrifice musically, totally. I hear it in your voice, you know, in the frustration. But on the flip side, there was so much success that you were very fortunate to have. And I just wonder if you were able to, because a lot of stars, you see, they did not keep it, you know, and you always look so good. You physically look so good. And I just, as a fan, I would just wonder, were you able to, when you had that enormous period, when all those songs were coming your way and they were all over the place, despite the fact that they, you know, you had these reservations about the process that made them, they did seem to help you in a lot of ways in financially, if you will.
Definitely. The whole industry changed. And, you know, I kind of took a step back and went, look, if it's a great song and we can play it, obviously we're not getting the publishing or the royalties, but, you know, if that one song is going to get people to buy the album, we wrote most of the songs on the album.
Right.
And I felt that way about the ballads in the early days. And it's like, if there's a song that I'm not crazy about, but the fans love it, great, because they're going to come and see us play. And there's a lot of other songs we wrote, so... And you know, it was only for a few years that artists wrote their own music. It basically started with the Beatles and that era. I mean, before that, it was pretty traditional for the artists to perform the songs, and the A&R guy would go out and find songs. Like Elvis is the prime example of you know, never really writing a song, you know, but. It didn't stop him from
building a huge,
you know,
legacy based on other songwriters. I get it. It's a great analogy.
You know, hugely successful. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, but it, you know, it kind of at first it took us a little while to get used to that. But you know, we were, and then some bring in some of the songwriters. I mean, into the team. I mean, Steven and I would go sometimes on a songwriting hunt, and we would go to New York, Nashville, Minneapolis, literally on a 2 or 3 week trip, and work with different people. And we would just come back with a pile of things, and some of them would work and some of them wouldn't. I only wish that, you know, in the early days when we were really cranking, we had done more material, because then we really don't have a lot. You would think that we would have a lot of stuff. It was never released, but because Steven took him so long to write lyrics, it would be like as soon as we'd get enough songs for an album, it would stop. It wouldn't be like we're going to record 20 songs and pick the best 10. We would go in with probably 4 or 5 songs, the guts of 4 or 5 songs, and then throw together the rest, you know, that we could to fill out the album, you know, say with Toys or Rocks, then immediately, you know, move on to the next step. For the most part, just about every other artist I know of, they would keep on writing, you know. But when I look back at it, I have to. It was just really hard, and it still is, for Steven to write lyrics. So rather than sit around and wait for another month to try and get some more songs, there had been a few things that we played, and literally I could count on one hand, but they never had lyrics. And that's why I ended up doing solo records after the project, because I would keep writing, like, say, the Red album, you know, the Joe Perry Red album, or You Have Guitar, Will Travel. It's just, I had all these riffs. And I was thinking, well, you know, at least when if something ever happens to me, Billy has all these riffs, but they're really not songs. And somebody else is going to have to finish them, and they're just going to be riffs. So I decided to finish them myself and either sing them or turn them into instrumentals. And then I was thinking, well, why wait till I'm dead? Why not put them out now? I'm still writing, you know. I've got there's a pile of riffs. That's why I loved having a studio. I mean, I've always had some kind of studio as soon as I could afford it, whether it was a little two-track cassette recorder to a four-track, and then getting when I had the room, I got an eight-track and a small board and some microphones. I've always had some kind of studio or some kind of place where I could lay down the ideas, and the one that I finally built, the Boneyard, let's get all the best gear you can get. I mean, it became one of my hobbies, you know, like collecting all the old gear, really just to, in case, you know, I came up with something on guitar, it would be good enough to put on a record. But as it turned out, just one more step and it was set up and up so I could record the whole band. And that's why we were able to do Honkin' on Bobo down there, as well as just Push Play. I mean, we recorded all that stuff, all that down in my studio.
When you mention that place, Joe, it does make me think of another sort of institution, if you will, of your own making there in the Boston area, where I had some memories definitely seeing you live once there, the Mama Kin Club.
Oh, yeah.
That takes a little pause. I'm sorry, brother. I mean, it was a great... I just would love to hear any memories of seeing you there and at the Middle East in the same week. I don't know, Joe. That is like... I've seen you at Foxborough, saw you at the Philly Spectrum, all these different places, but nothing touched seeing you at... I think the Middle East really was hands down my very favorite, but the Mama Kin was very special too. Anything you want to just share about that place and what it meant to you?
Well, one thing that we learned, and this helped through too, we had a restaurant from a good friend of mine that I'd gotten to know on the South Shore. We'd talked about, he had some restaurants in town, and we'd talked about opening up a place down on the South Shore that was like, you know, a kind of a neighborhood place, so we would have a place to go and hang out and get a good pizza or whatever. And so I had asked Steven if he wanted to come in with me on it, and so we were kind of partners in that. But we were on the road all the time, and it was kind of hard to keep. I mean, we had, you know, some people that we trusted to run it, but still, it's like a cash business, and anytime there's cash, you kind of have to be around to kind of keep your eye on it. You know, it just. The nature of business, you know what I mean? And Mama Kin was kind of the same way. We were partners with guys that, you know, owned probably four or five clubs in town up and down the same street, and we'd be gone for 6 months at a time, and we were wondering why, well, listen, the place is doing well. How come we're not seeing any, how come we're always in the red?
Right.
You know, and it was that kind of a thing. And so we basically sold off our part of it. But for a while, it was, we had meant for it to be a place where we could go and hang out and do more shows and that kind of thing. But practically, we weren't around that much. You know, we weren't in town. We were like either off recording in Vancouver or we were on the road somewhere. And so it was really hard for any one of us to actually physically go in there and do what we had originally planned. So, you know, we tried it out, and it was a lot of fun. The fans had a good time. People would come from out of town just to stop by and see the memorabilia. But, you know, unless you're ready to lose some money, it's not the kind of business you go in unless you're going to devote all your time and get to it, you know. And frankly, we're artists, and that was our main focus, you know. So
it was an experiment, but the gig was cool there. Yeah. How about the Middle East? I mean, what a gig that was. The Middle East downstairs?
Well, we kind of felt like, because, you know, there's always that, you know, Cambridge-Boston
rivalry
scene, and then there's on the other side of the Charles is the Boston, Newbury Street kind of, you know, there are two scenes going on, and we felt like we'd be doing a disservice to one or the other if we didn't play both places. So we figured, well, let's make a thing out of it and, you know, play both. And so that was the deal with that.
Hey, I'll leave you with this because you've given me a lot of time and I really appreciate it, but you sort of left it in a great place to do so. You know, you started out the whole thing 1300 block of Comm Ave in Boston, right near the Bottled Liquors sign. I lived a block from that liquor store. And then just recently, in the last several years, you went back, you played there right in the street. We were all privileged that it was shot. You could watch it. You could share it with people around the world. Do things like that bring emotion, and where does the greatest sense of joy or just power come for you these days on like a spiritual note when I think of watching you on stage there that day?
Well, I have to say it was pretty stunning to stand there. And, you know, I mean, there were people wanted to they're going, oh, we can't do it. It's not big enough. There were a lot of people like that really didn't want to do it the way we did it. And I just kept saying, look, we're on the road talking about it. And the mayor had been wanting to do this, put that plaque on the place for literally years and years. And I just said, man, we've got to do it this way. We've got to play on the street. And I wanted to play right on the stoop, you know, and just set up right there. But, you know, the way it worked out, it was, we came in on a kind of a flatbed kind of thing. And they shut down the trains. And with all those people showing up, I have to say it was pretty stunning to be able to look up at the apartment window, you know, where we lived, and then look out at all those people, you know. It was a timeless moment. I have to say, knowing what it took to get it together and all the paperwork and the permits and getting the permission from the mayor and all that. But it was a really amazing day. And it's one of those moments you never forget.
Is the Bottled Liquor sign still there, the flashing?
You know, I'll tell you, for all the changes and all the businesses that have come and gone, to see that store that's still there. Were you there when the Hofbräu was there? Right next to it, they had it was kind of like a German kind of beer hall kind of thing.
I think it was right next door
to the liquor store, and I think that it had been torn down by the time we were there for this gig. But to see the liquor store there and it looked pretty much the same was like it helped to
cement it
all that time,
right?
You know?
I'm with you, brother. Well, God bless the mayor who just passed recently and yourself. I really appreciated the book. Is Rocks, My Life in and Out of Aerosmith, Joe Perry, and a lot of great stories. I hope this kept you somewhat interested in terms of conversation. I appreciate it, dude.
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. It's great, and especially since you know the area there, you know. It's pretty cool. So, anyway,
I appreciate
thanks.
It, brother. I really do, Joe. I give you a big hug. I met you many times when you were getting the Hasty Pudding Award. I got to meet you. I met you at the I met you at the Mama Kin. I met you at the Middle East a few different at BCN one time. I mean, a bunch of different times. Had so many memories back then, and
wow.
I meant what I said. It was great to see you up there at that 1300 block of Comm Ave. I lived right there on Kelton Street, right behind there.
I've walked all those streets, all those blocks.
I know you did.
I mean, God, you know, looking for a place to park. you could make a half an hour trip somewhere and then spend 2 hours looking for a place to park. I mean, it was really, but you know, everybody did it. So
Austin Rock City and the park, even having that parking permit, didn't do a damn thing, but believe it or not, I saved mine, Joe. I still have it on the wall here in my apartment in Honolulu. I have the big red Austin Brighton parking permit sign.
Wow. No kidding.
Yeah, I had it. Came down one day. Somebody hit it. I just figured I'll take it. I kept it there. So when I moved here, I brought it. Hey, man, be safe. God bless you and your family.
Great. Thanks very much. You too. I'll talk to you.
Aloha, dude.
Thanks. Bye.